Matt, and thank you everybody for the invitation. It's really nice to be back, although not in person, but hopefully soon. Okay, so today I would like to give a bit of an overview on gravitational waves from inflation and some recent work of mine. And before I get started, let me just acknowledge my wonderful collaborators. So during this talk, I will touch upon a few papers and I will a few topics and related papers, and these are my collaborators for the papers I'll be mentioning, some of whom are based at Perimeter or Waterloo. So this is like an outline of what I'll be discussing. I will do a brief introduction, hopefully it's going to be useful if there are students in the audience, on gravitational waves from inflation. What do we expect? So the questions I will ask how does a gravitational stochastic gravitational wave background from inflation look like? What kind of information can we extract about inflation if we are able to observe it? And how can we characterize it? Because we know that we expect stochastic gravitational wave background not only for inflation, but also from other hypothetical processes, as well as from astrophysics. So I will be discussing some of the signatures and observables that we use to characterize it. Along the, you know, this discussion, I will also mentioning some models just to so that we can have an overview, although not exhaustive, of course, of what we can expect inflation to produce in terms of gravitational wave background. So let me say just a few words very quickly on inflation, as I'm sure the audience is familiar with this. I am focused on this early epoch of accelerated expansion of our universe. And we know inflation is wonderful because it allows us to make sense of observations, like it explains the nearly perfectly uniformity of the temperature in the cosmic microwave background. It gives an explanation how the tiny temperature fluctuations we observe were produced. And throughout this presentation, and when I refer to single fissile roll, I'm talking about the class of models which are the simplest, where you have inflation realized with one scalar field, which is in slow roll. We'll be referring to this simple paradigm as SFSR, single fissile roll. And of course, the goal is to also explore other possibilities because this is like the simplest vanilla scenario. Oftentimes I will write down the phi, which is the inflaton, and within inflation, within this this paradigm, what we think happened is that the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton were responsible for then generating the cosmological perturbations. So, I will be referring to also wave number and EFOLs for the fluctuations. So during inflation, these perturbations are amplified by the expansion and stretch. They become super horizon, they freeze in. During inflation is this first part of the time evolution. And then after inflation, the modes at some point they re-enter and they become dynamical again, carrying, of course, the information on that were imprinted during in the very early universe during inflation. And of course, looking at different wavelength or wave numbers means probing different times during inflation. We know that inflation must have lasted something like 50 to 60 EFOLs at least. And so if we look at this is the length scale. So you can think of it as wavelength, for example. So if we're looking at larger wavelength, we're looking at earlier times. Smaller wavelength, we're looking at later times during inflation. Okay, so these are some main facts. And then the other key prediction, the other important thing, which is what this talk is mostly focused on, is the gravitational wave produced during inflation. So there's a key prediction for inflation, which is the production of stochastic gravitational wave background. And okay, when we think about gravitational waves, of course, we are this expression I'm writing down is gamma ij, the two polarization states of the graviton. And let me also write down the evolution equation, which we're going to need later on for the graviton. So on the left hand side, we have our let's say wave equation on top of the addition of a term which accounts for the expansion of the universe. And on the right hand side, we have everything that comes from that can contribute to delta Tij, the anisotropic stress energy tensor. And so I mean this equation is meant during inflation. And in general, if you want to write down the most general solution to this solution equation, it's gonna be made up by the sum of two parts, which is solution to the homogeneous part, to the homogeneous equation, like said in the right hand side, to zero. And this is actually what we call gravitational waves from vacuum fluctuations. And then I added up to the solution to the inhomogeneous equation. And so the features of the homogeneous solution, I will discuss it in a moment, but basically if you set the usual Banach Davis initial states and you have just GR, they are basically predetermined. On the other hand, if one starts looking at the solution to the homogeneous equation, so which you have when you account for the right hand side, then that solution is much more model dependent, because it depends on your set of fields that you have in your inflationary model. And so on the one hand, it's very model dependent. On the other hand, it is very interesting because it allows you to probe the more specific, you know, it's more specific to the models, and it provides more information in a sense compared to the homogeneous solution when it's there, when it's important. Okay, but I will come back to this in a bit. And okay, this is just the same plot as before, just like for scalar perturbations, same for tensor perturbations, which then give rise to the gravitational wave background after inflation, after these modes re-enter the horizon. We think of frequencies as in a one-to-one correspondence, let's say between with the time during inflation. So if we are looking at very high frequencies, which means very small wavelength for the stochastic gravitational wave background, means we are probing the later phase of the expansion of inflation. If we're looking at the smaller frequencies or higher wavelength, we're probing the earlier phase. So it is interesting to, have access to as many frequencies as possible. And of course, we are lucky in that sense because we have all these experiments with which we can access the gravitational waves from inflation. So inflation predicts gravitational waves throughout these frequencies from some very, very small ones, let's say, of the order of the age of the universe, which of course we cannot observe directly, but it can be accessed through the imprints in the CMB, through the very, very high, which we can access with interferometers. And in this talk, so let me focus now on what are the features of this stochastic gravitational wave background from inflation. So again, I'm back to the simplest model, a single phase slow roll. And as I said, in this case, for standard gravity, GR, and if we don't make any assumption beyond this, then we have a very precise prediction. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the amplitude of the gravitational waves, so You can think of it in terms of power spectrum or energy density carried by the stochastic background and the energy scale of inflation. So measuring, knowing that, for instance, the tensor to scalar ratio would tell us what is the Hubble scale during inflation. And then the other property that we have is a red tilt, which means that the power spectrum is decreasing when going from the from large towards the small scales, and we will see what this implies in terms of observations. And then the other property is chirality. In this, in the vanilla scenario, there is no parity violation, and we expect the two helicities of the tensor perturbations to behave exactly the same. So for example, we have the same amplitude for the power spectrum for the left and the right helicities. And the other property, which I will discuss in the second part of my talk, is Gaussianity is nearly perfect, is very small non-Gaussianity, let's say it's nearly Gaussian. And I will say more about this in a bit. So, but let me now focus on the red tilt property. So I plotted here the sensitivity curves for a number of experiments, which we are going to probe stochastic background on the, these are the sensitivity lines, and then I'm plotting the energy density of this background. And in, oh, these are the constraint, this is the constraint from CMB. So this is the current constraint, and this is what Liber would constrain, the limit that Liber would be able to set. And this black line represents what this scenario, the standard single phase low roll predicts. And this is just the gravitational waves from vacuum fluctuations, because the inhomogeneous solution in the standard single phase low roll is subdominant. So that's all we need to worry about. And as you can see, this line is pretty much straight, but a little bit goes a little bit down, going from the lowest to the highest frequencies. And so, for example, something like LISA would not be able to observe it if even for a tensor to scalar ratio close to the current CMB bound. BBO might be able to observe it, but not the other experiment. And one question I will be asking in this talk is, can inflation predict something beyond this if we go beyond the simplest vanilla scenario? So like, could we have like some kind of blue tilt, or could we have some kind of bump localized that could be interesting for, you know, these experiments that are coming up? So this is one of the questions. So, but in any case, that plot tells us that, for example, if we were to observe something with LISA, we think it's primordial, it would not be from inflation. Or, well, at the same time, then we would have to, well, if we restrict ourselves to single phase slow roll. So it could be something beyond that. Or we also have to keep in mind, of course, in this talk I will be super simplifying because I will refer mostly to inflation, but we have to also keep in mind that a stochastic gravitational wave background is expected also from the astrophysical sources. So we expect a background due to the superposition of resolved astrophysical sources. And also we should keep into account the fact that Rigidi may have generated a visible background, or phase transition may have generated an observable background, cosmic strings. And we also have to keep in mind that there are alternatives to inflation with their prediction. So on the side of the cosmological sources, we have to keep an open mind of all these processes that can potentially generate a visible stochastic gravitational wave background. And we have to keep in mind that we also expect it from astrophysical sources. And of course, the approach is to, at least the, let's say, the message in this talk will be to look for ways to characterize the background, in my case, especially from inflation, and to distinguish from the others. And also within inflation to figure out what the different classes of models may predict that deviate from the single fixed overall scenario. So for example, the spectral shape, which means of course, looking at how this line goes with frequency is one possibility that will help identify the source of the background. Now, another one is chirality, which I mentioned earlier, which is zero, basically. There's no chirality in the basic scenario. And also, the astrophysical is expected to be stochastic gradation with background is expected to be non-chiral. So if we were to see some signature of chirality, we would probably be thinking about cosmological origin for what we are observing. And chirality generally points to parity breaking, and one could realize it in a number of ways. For example, if you have parity breaking in your theory of gravity or your matter content and interactions. And in this talk, I will give an example of chiral gravitational wave background from inflation. Of course, we have to keep in mind that there are other possibilities. For example, in this talk, I will be focusing on models where you have an interaction like this one, where F is a gauge field and F tilde is its strength, and they're coupled to an axiom. So let me go into that. And this is an example, and then I will be discussing how we can test chirality in practice. But this example, I give it to you not only because I've been working on it on this class of models, which we call axiom gauge field, like to be broad. But also I like to talk about this because historically this class of models has been very, let's say, useful for a number of reasons. There are people like this is an incomplete, very incomplete list of people who have been now working in this topic. So what are the ingredients of this class of models? You have an axion like field, which in this case, okay, I call phi, but I will call it a different name later on. Sorry about that. And then you have gauge fields. Okay, so we have ingredients which are often found in particle physics models, and they also concern the post-inflationary universe. And these class of models were historically introduced to make sense of to basically explain how to keep the inflaton field very light so that you can sustain inflation for a sufficient duration. But they have been all these models are also interesting because you can support reheating, you can provide a mechanism for baryogenesis, they can lead to primordial black hole formation, and so on. And in this, for what I'm going to be talking about today, we will be focused on the fact that in these models you can source scattered gravitational waves. So all you need is, as I said, an axial-like field coupled to some gauge fields, which could be like a U1 gauge field or a S2 gauge field or other types. And let me just go back to the slide that I showed earlier. So in this case, what I will be focusing on is within these models is the solution that you have on top of the vacuum fluctuation. So the solution that you have that is coming from taking a non-zero right-hand side. And in these models that I will be looking into, which belong to the axiom gauge field class, in particular, you have tensor perturbations coming from the gauge fields, which are going to basically source the tensor modes of the metric and therefore the gravitational waves. So let me just give you the action so that we know what we're talking about. So we have an inflaton, say sector, which can be anything you want. And then you have a spectator, what we call a spectator sector, because their energy density doesn't need to be large. Actually, if it's not large, we have more freedom. So we have some additional fields which are there. We're assuming that they are there. And we have chi, which is our axion-like field. And then if given the symmetries around Lagrangian, you're allowed to write this coupling between chi and the gauge field. And this coupling is crucial because the rolling of the axion is basically going to result in energy being dumped into the gauge field sector, which are going to be sustained. Otherwise, they would decay right away because they have the gauge field perturbations have a mass in this model. Because these gauge fields are SU2, you have basically a purely tensor component, and this purely tensor component can source the gravitational waves linearly. And this is a crucial feature of this specific set of models, which belong to the axion gauge field class, Broad class. And the specificity is that because these tensor perturbations are of the gauge field are tensorial, because this gauge field have tensor perturbations, the same tensor perturbations can now source linearly also the scalar perturbations. And therefore, you can have, an amplification of your gravitational waves, or in other words, you can have an inhomogeneous, a solution to the inhomogeneous equation, which can be comparable to the solution to the homogeneous equation, so to the quantum, the gravitational waves from the vacuum fluctuations, without doing any damage to the scalar sector, precisely because the same fields cannot source in the same way the inflaton perturbation. So this is like one nice feature of these models. And of course, you would say, okay, you have these extra gravitational waves, but what do we do with those? And the thing is, as I said before, there's going to be some properties which are useful to distinguish them from the gravitational waves from vacuum fluctuations. And in this case, the properties have to do with actually all those that I mentioned earlier. So there's the chirality, because there is parity breaking in this model. So you're going to produce a left different from the right helicity. And then you're going to have an amplification. So, okay, let me just go say on this slide, you're going to have a profile for the power spectrum, and therefore for the amplitude of the tensor perturbations, or of the gravitational wave background, which is different from the one you have. It's not, in this case, it's not necessarily red tilted. And we'll see how it looks like. And then you can have some non-Gaussianity. So you have a number of features that would allow you to, distinguish it from other inflation models and possibly also from other type of cosmological backgrounds. So as I said, the gauge field is been amplified thanks to the coupling with the axion-like field, and then just going to source the gravitational waves, and one of the helicities will have a jump, and that will be overproduced with respect to the other. So you have chirality. And this is what the frequency profile could look like. It could be like a log normal. And people have, for instance, in Max Planck, have done some forecasts to see what kind of experiments could be useful to probe these specific class of models. For instance, in this plot, they show how LISA will be able to, in principle, detect it, as well as Lightbird, but maybe not SK or Einstein Telescope. And so, as I said, you no longer have a red tilt. You can have a bump. You no longer have the left and the right equal. You have some chiral signature, and also as you can see from this formula, there is no more a one to one. There is no longer a one to one correspondence between H and R. So that will have to be revised. So if we were to observe something, then we would not like a value of R non-zero CME scales would not be put in a one to one correspondence with H in this case. I'm gonna spend a few slides just. Because I think it's interesting to think about how do we detect chirality. So the profile, the frequency profile is pretty, it's pretty intuitive how to measure it. You measure it over as much large as large an interval of frequencies that you can, so you can reconstruct it across a range of scales, and that way you can see what kind of profile you have, so the frequency profile or tilt, you can test it, of course. Now, how about chirality? There are a number of ways to test chirality. If we are looking at very, very high frequencies, so on CMB scales, we know that we can test it by looking for non-zero cross-correlations between temperature and depolarization with the B. And now, the group at Max Planck did some forecasts on our model, and they found out what kind of amplitude you need at CMB scales in order to see a non-zero cross correlation within our model. And okay, there are some constraints and so on that can be put by an experiment like LIBOR, for example. Now, if we move from very, very low to high frequency, where we can, for instance, interferometer, we are dealing with interferometers or with pulsar timing arrays. There are techniques there as well that people have been looking into, and I have this slide. It's like a summary of some of the recent works. So in principle, as a guideline, if you have a planar detector, so a single interferometer, you could not distinguish a left polarized from a right, not a left polarized, but you could not tell if your gravitational wave is circularly polarized, which means it has a left component larger than the right or vice versa. And this is precisely because of the geometry. And so what you need to do is to basically effectively break this planarity. And you could, one way people have, have proposed is to use different detectors, which are non-coplanar, which are located at different positions. Or you could use the fact that you can even use a single detector, but in that case, you have to resort to, not to the monopole, but to the higher multiples, using the fact that the detector is in motion because it's basically in the solar system. So there is a velocity that we can exploit. And we can use the higher multiples, starting with the dipole, in order to extract information on chirality, because you're basically effectively changing the direction. And you're breaking the planarity in that case. But in this case, you have to resort to higher multiples, so you are a little bit less sensitive. But this is a good solution when you cannot, for instance, in the case of LISA, if you have a single detector in space, then you could do that. Or of course, you can do that on Earth as well using different detectors. For detectors on Earth, if you have multiple detectors on Earth, then the first way, of course, is more efficient because you can directly use the monopole. And then people have also considered PTA. So we have an idea on how to constrain chirality. And just to give you some numbers, again, in Ichiro's work with this group at Max Planck, and they did some forecasts for our models to see what LISA-like or VBO-like experiment would be able to constrain in terms of chirality signatures. When I say LISA-like, I mean two constellations, because in this case, they are considering extracting chirality from the monopole. Okay, so this is as far as these signatures are concerned. We got an idea of what can generate a non-chiral signal, a chiral signal, how can we constrain it? Okay, the frequency profile is an obvious way to distinguish within models, within inflation, or between inflation and other cosmological sources for gravitational waves. And then the rest of the talk, I would like to discuss non-Gaussianity. So this is another important observable. And I will be discussing both from the point of view of the Cosmic Migraine background, but not spending too much time there because that has been going on for much longer. So we kind of have a lot of, you know, accumulated knowledge in that direction. And I will be discussing it more from the point of view of what interferometers could, what constraints we could get on non-gastronomy from interferometers. And this is also related to the topic of anisotropies in the stochastic gravitational wave background, which is also fairly, let's say, fairly recent, especially in comparison with the work on non-gastronomy that has been going on for the cosmic microwave background. So let me get into non-gaussianity. So just for the people who don't work on this topic, for the students who don't work on this topic, when we talk about non-gaussianity, we mean going beyond the power spectrum. And so we're looking at three or higher point correlations. And in this specific talk, I will be focused on the non-gaussianity of the tensor modes and or the mixed non-gaussianity, because I'm interested in discussing some feature, some this observable from the point of view of constraining observations of gravitational waves. And when we talk about non-gaussianity, we always define an amplitude. So when you see FNL is the characteristic amplitude defined as the amplitude, in this case, for the bispectrum, which is the lowest order endpoint function, higher than two-point function, is the bispectrum divided by the power spectrum square. So that this is something dimensionless. And then we define non-gaussianity in terms of shape. Shape means, so if I'm correlating three modes, K1, K2, K3, in general, the momentum dependence of this function. And in this talk, I will be mostly referring to, I will not be discussing a specific shapes, but I will be referring to specific configurations. And depending on your model, of course, you have different predictions which make your signal more visible in one configuration or the other. And I will be first mentioning the equilateral, and then the rest of the talk will be about the squeeze configuration. So squeeze configuration means that I'm looking into one of the wave numbers being wavelength much longer than the other two in this case. So let me give you an example right away. Oh, sorry, before I give you the example, in general, when we think about non-gaussianity, primordial non-gaussianity, of course, we are thinking about something that is testing the interactions of the fields during inflation. So in the case of the tensors, you are testing interaction or either the self-interactions or the interactions of the tensor modes with other fields. So that just as a general idea. So for example, in the model that I discussed with axions and gauge field, you can have your tensor modes of the metric interacting with the gauge fields. And this can lead to contributions through non-gaussianity to the bispectrum in this case, which are not present, of course, in the Balinese scenario of inflation. And so you can have large FNL, large-ish, detectable, and so on. And also you can have like mixed non-gaussianity. So you can have a scalar tensor-tensor bispectrum mediated also by this gauge field. So this is an example on how you can generate a non-gaussianity, observable non-gaussianity. And here I've put some typical magnitude for in these models compared to the typical magnitude that you have in basis single field inflation. So this is just to stress that this is an interesting observable, of course, important observable for in order to be able to identify the kind of fields and interactions that you have in your inflationary Lagrangian. Now let's move on to interferometers. So what does it mean to look at the non-gaussianity at interferometers? So first of all, I drew here a very very simple picture just to get into the spirit. So we are here looking with receiving our stochastic background. Of course, if we want to measure non-gaussianity, we're measuring the correlation between, for example, for the bispectrum between three modes, and the length of this triangle with of these sides will be the gravitational wave frequency, and the direction will be the incoming direction of these gravitational waves. But the thing is, if you want to do with interferometers, what we do for the CMB, so measure three-point correlations, that is, so you measure where the modes are all at interferometer scale, so you want to actually measure a bispectrum directly, that is not in general a possibility. And that reason is that you have, even if you have in your model that predicts this, let's say you know the gravitational waves are from inflation and they are non-Gaussian because your model tells you so, even if they are generated and they are non-Gaussian when they're generated in the model, even if they're generated, the gravitational waves produced during inflation and they are non-Gaussian, they will be Gaussian by the time you measure them, if you're trying to measure, do a direct measurement with interferometers. And the reason is that as the tensor modes propagate, the gravitational wave propagate through the structure, there is a decorrelation. And you can think of it in terms of a Shapiro time delay. So you have a, if I write down the evolution equation in the post-inflationary universe from the time the modes re-enter inside the horizon throughout their propagation towards us, I work under the simplified assumption of geometric optics. So I'm treating the long wavelength perturbation as much, much longer than the gravitational wave background. You have an extra term in the evolution equation, which is this, and this is the curvature perturbation. And this extra term will introduce basically a time shift in your mode function. So you have e to the ik tau plus delta tau. And this time shift will depend on the specific direction associated with that particular tensor mode. So what that means is that at the end of the day, if you try and write down your bispectrum, you get zero. You get a decorrelation precisely because you have this direction-dependent time shift. So you would say, okay, then what's there for us for non-Gaussianity in terms of interferometer measurements and interferometers? And the answer is that you can still measure non-Gaussianity, although in the specific configurations and for specific shape, and using using observables such as anisotropies, which I'm going to focus about here. There are other possibilities. In this case, I'm focusing on the on these signatures of ultra-squeeze non-Gaussianity, which can be detected in the form of anisotropies of the stochastic gravitational wave background. So let me explain how this works. What I'm going to focus on is the configuration where you have one very long wavelength and two short wavelengths. So the two short wavelengths are, let's say, LISA scale or ET scale or BBO scale or PTA scale. And the very long wavelength is very, very long. So it has, this mode has not undergone propagation. So in this case, you could think of your signal as originating from the same patch. If this mode is very, very long, these two modes are almost, let's say, parallel to one another. So instead of looking at the signal that is coming from the superposition of different patches, you're looking at one patch. So this is already telling you that in principle, you would not be undergoing this time delay effect. Because you're basically focusing on one patch. Now, this just to suggest, to give the idea. Now I'm going to show you what I mean, what kind of observables I'm referring to. But before I do that, let me summarize as follows. If you have some primordial non-Gaussianity in the ultra-squeeze limit, so one wavelength much smaller than the other two, and you have a sizable signal in this configuration, you can look for signatures of this non-Gaussianity in the form of anisotropies of the stochastic gravitational wave background. So if I write down omega GW, which is the energy density of my background, and I consider the different, I decompose it into contributions from the different directions. This delta GW, which is my anisotropy, will be sensitive to ultra-squeeze non-Gaussianity, if there is such a thing, if there, your model predicts an ultra-squeeze non-Gaussianity and this omega GW is the omega GW from that model. Okay, so let me say a few more about how these signatures are generated. So this that they back to the ideal fossils, which were developed initially by Marko Minkowski, and then we continue developing altogether with many applications to inflation. So if you have the idea is that if you have a long wavelength mode, you which is correlated with the short wavelength mode, so you have a correlation in the squeeze limit, a bispectrum, basically a squeeze bispectrum, you can introduce a modulation in the premolar power spectrum of the short wavelength mode. And this modulation will be, I wrote it here as an example, the amplitude of this modulation is determined by the coupling, so by the three-point, the bispectrum amplitude, this FNL, and is determined also by the amplitude of the long wavelength mode. So in general, if you have this modulation, you have like a degeneracy between the amplitude of the interaction between this long wavelength mode, which could be a different field compared to the short wavelengths. Like you could have a scalar with two tensors, or you could have a tensor with two other tensors. And it depends also on the amplitude of the long wavelength mode. So this is the general idea. And it can be applied, both to scalar and tensor perturbations. For instance, in this case, in this recent work with Matteo Fasello and Giammasio Tassinato, we applied it to interferometer science, because after it was realized that we could not measure that by spectrum directly, we thought this could be a good way to constrain the bispectrum with interferometers looking for this correction to the biospectrum, which goes into the anisotropies of the energy density of the stochastic gravitational wave background. So this was our proposal, and in this case, then you get because of this long short mode coupling, you get a correction to the power spectrum, and therefore you get an anisotropy in the energy density of the gravitational waves. And this anisotropy will tell you what the amplitude of the long wavelength mode is that is modulating your short wavelength modes, and what is the intensity of the coupling between these three modes. So what is the amplitude of your premolar bispectrum? So this is the idea. And as I said, you could apply it to a tensor-tensor-tensor, to a tensor-tensor-scalar. So if you have a scalar tensor-tensor non-Gaussianity, the scalar would modulate the tensors on small scales, and you would have an anisotropy in the energy density of the stochastic gravitational wave background generated by the long wavelength mode, which is coupled to the short wavelength mode with some, magnitude, FNL STT. So now what...
Emma, sorry. I had a question about that. So, so you mentioned how these short wavelength modes suffer this, decorrelation from this, small scale Shapiro time delays, right?
Right.
So then when you try to then estimate the squeezed bispectrum, the noise on that then should depend on the trispectrum of those small scale modes, right? I'm just wondering, is the noise on this small enough that this is measurable or not? I guess, once you account for the non-Gaussianity of these very small scale modes.
Yes. I will talk about noise in a little bit. I would say whether this is measurable or not, in order to find out whether this is measurable or not, you have to see how large is the monopole, as well as how large is the noise, let's say the noise angular power spectrum for your instrument. Those are the two ingredients that really determine. And then, so you need a very large, in that, let's say, much larger than the limit that we have on CMB scales, you will have a large non-Gaussianity. Well, if I'm thinking about scalar non-Gaussian, because there are no stringent constraints on the tensor and the mixed. So in terms of how large you need it, those are the two ingredients that enter. I'm not sure how the tri-spectrum would get into the picture. Maybe we can discuss this.
Well, yeah. Well, okay. Right? For this decorrelation effect that you mentioned, you know, so what sort of scalar modes, in the density field are responsible, for most of this decorrelation? Like, do you know? Or?
So yeah, the thing is, this formula, for example, that I showed to you, it's very simplified in a sense that we are treating the scalar as very, very long wavelength compared to the tensor. So we're looking very, very long wavelength. And I think, I don't know if anything more, precise or more generic than this has been done. So here there is really a larger hierarchy of scales between the tensors and the scalars in order to get to this result. So right, you're looking at an FRW background with superimposed very long wavelength perturbations.
Long here just means long compared to the gravitational wave.
Yes.
Wavelength, which is something super tiny, right?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Okay. As long as you have this hierarchy, then you can write this formula. So I don't know if that.
Sure.
Yeah.
But for you, I guess, here a long wavelength, for the scalar mode, here in this context might be ultra short wavelength in the cosmological structure formation context, right?
I think so, because we're talking about 10 to the 10 megaparsec inverse for the tensors.
Yeah, exactly.
10 to the 12 or something. So it's still fairly, yeah, it could still be, you're right, it could still be very short. We just need an hierarchy of between the two for this result to be trusted.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's see. I think I can show you some more results for this. So let's see where I was. I was here. So in this case, you have a tensor scalar scale, a scalar tensor tensor. So you're testing the tensor, the scalar tensor tensor by spectrum with these anisotropies. I just wanted to, I don't want to talk too much about models, but just to give an idea, because you might wonder, okay, what do we need to ask of our inflation models for these signatures to be interesting observationally, to have to be large enough to be observed? So one nice way, I think, to think about classes of models that could generate large signals in this kind of signatures in the squeeze limit would be models where you have additional fields. And these additional fields need to be not too massive, otherwise there's not much superhorizon evolution. So you tend to have some equilateral non-Gaussianity instead of squeezed, as it is the case, for example, with the fields, with the gauge field modules that I discussed earlier. So you need something that is light enough that it gives you some superhorizon evolution. Or you could also, the models with Naumann-Davis initial states can do the trick, or models where you have some kind of breaking of space diffs. But there are, these are three possibilities. And I would say, in general, the soft limits are an ideal probe if you have extra field content, if you have some not excited initial states during inflation, so which are maybe signaling some pre-inflationary dynamics, or if you have non-standard symmetry patterns. So you have, for example, breaking of space dips. I'm not saying this is exhaustive. There are other possibilities. And in the simplest model, it's not that their signatures are not there, but they're not there at a level that is interesting for observations. The last few minutes, I wanted to maybe say a few more words about anisotropies of the stochastic gravitational wave background, because I think it's very exciting. It's exciting for me, but also for many other people who are working on this at the moment. So, of course, I told you, okay, we can have these anisotropies in the stochastic gravitational wave background. We can probe them, and we can test primordial non-Gaussianity. But we have to keep in mind that other kinds of anisotropies are expected in the stochastic gravitational wave background, not only actually from inflation, but for all the cosmological background, which could be phase transitions or cosmic strings or end of inflation, like reheating kind of processes. And these are the anisotropies that are imprinted just like on the stochastic gravitational background, just like they're imprinted on the CMB photons by the structure in the universe. So we are talking about Sachs-Wolfe, integrated Sachs-Wolfe, and so on. And in a very simplified treatment that was proposed in a paper by Aldo Maldacena, you can think of these as anisotropies as originating from a direction-dependent frequency shift, which is related to the value of the curvature perturbation and different directions. And this will end up generating an anisotropy, which is then proportional to the curvature perturbation, to the large-scale curvature perturbations, times some factor which is related to the spectral index of your background. So, okay, this is the simplified Maldacena treatment. Then people later on, Carlo Contaldi and the group of Sabino and Nicola in Padova also did the full Boltzmann treatment of these gravitational wave anisotropies to stress, you know, how the Sachs-Wolfe, the integrated Sachs-Wolfe, come into picture. So we have to keep in mind these anisotropies are imprinted on all this cosmological background. So just to make a comparison, then, what are the magnitudes of these anisotropies? The magnitude of these anisotropies, let's say, from propagation, or we call them induced in our paper, but let me see, propagation or induced, they are of the order of the curvature perturbation, so around 10 to the minus 5. This is the large scale curvature perturbation. And now this would have to be compared with the anisotropies from non-Gaussianity, which is then the curvature perturbation times FNL. So depending on how large your FNL is in your model, then you would have anisotropies from propagation dominator, anisotropies from non-Gaussianity dominator, the two being comparable. So it's highly model dependent, like in this work with my student Amik, UNSW. This plot is taken from our work. We show for different types of primordial non-Gaussianity what you can have in terms of angular power spectrum of these anisotropy compared to what you have from the Sachs-Wolfe. Okay, and then the other important thing that I want to stress, and then I will conclude, is that because you have these anisotropies generated by the long wave perturbation, of course, they are correlated with the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. And with a group of collaborators, including Anya Yash, we were the first to propose cross correlations. And cross correlations are important because if you think of, if you, for example, think of anisotropies due, which you can also find in the astrophysical stochastic gravitational wave background, and that's due to the fact that sources are inhomogeneously distributed. In that case, type of anisotropies, you do not expect to find large correlation. Well, order one, even order one correlation, you expect to find very small correlation on large scales with the CMB. So this cross correlation could be one example, one observable that we can use to distinguish the anisotropies from, let's say, cosmological background, either induced by due to the propagation through structure or due to premodern Gaussianity from those in the astrophysical background. And especially if you happen to have your a very noisy map of your anisotropies and you cannot like fully characterize them, then the cross correlation could be a good way to make sense of them. And so, okay. And then if you guys are interested, I refer you to our work, not only the one with Yash and collaborators, but also those late, you know, the more recent ones with Matteo and okay, a number of collaborators like Maresche, Dan, and Giorgio, and Amik, of course, and in our paper, in our more recent paper, for example, we look at the error and the relative error on FNL for different types of experiments, for different types of backgrounds, for different types of angular dependence of your bispectrum. And then we refer to a few applications. So I'm not gonna go into those more technical details, but I'm happy to answer any questions if you're curious. So I'm going to conclude and just to give the possibility of if anyone has any other questions. So gravitational waves are useful to test inflation. And I want to stress also at interferometer scales. Interferometer scales are also very interesting for inflation because as soon as we go beyond the simple vanilla scenario, and we have many reasons to do that, both theoretical and phenomenological, then we can see, you know, we can predict signals which are of interest for interferometer searches. And I will, in my talk, I only mentioned a few classes of models where you can have a production of gravitational waves beyond, on top of what you have from vacuum fluctuations. And I mentioned, let's say, three classes of observables that we use, not only to characterize a hypothetical stochastic gravitational wave background from inflation, but also to distinguish it from other cosmological sources and from the astrophysical stochastic gravitational wave background. And of course, I didn't go too much in detail so what the other sources and the astrophysical predict, but there's a lot of work in that direction too. And I'm happy to point to some interesting literature if you're curious. So I would say spectral shape, chorality, and non-Gaussianity and anisotropy are our main observables. And I thank you for your attention, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, great. Thanks very much, Emma. So let's all unmute. Gotta give her a round of applause for her great talk.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay, are there any questions for Emma? We have maybe like a couple of minutes for that. Jesse, yeah, go ahead, please.
Hey, so this is probably going to be a somewhat poorly phrased question, but I'm interested in the cross-correlation you were talking about between the stochastic gravitational wave background and the CMB. Does the amount of that correlation, how much does that depend, or does it even matter sort of like at what redshift the gravitational wave background is sourced at, or is it just that it needs to go through the same potential fluctuations that produce the SW effect on the CMB?
Yeah, so we are looking into, you have to think of in this case, of sources that are, let's say, during the radiation-dominated era, or after inflation, which are modes that are re-entering during the radiation-dominated era. So for example, if you think about the astrophysical background, you're not gonna see those kind of effects because it's produced much later on. So in that case, the anisotropies would be a much smaller scales.
Okay, further questions? Well, I was actually curious about, you know, what you said about, you know, detecting chirality using just a single detector. So you mentioned how, you know, this is possible if you can measure higher multiples in the, a higher L in the monopole. Do you know what sort of L's we can expect to determine, you know, in the case that a stochastic background is detected?
Yeah, so for example, there is this work that I mentioned where they computed the signal to noise ratio for the dipole. And in that case, if you have a large enough background, which for LISA, they did that for LISA, they considered the motion of LISA, well, with the solar system, not the motion of the detector around the Earth, because that would be too small. So in that case, you can see something if your gravitational wave background is of the order 10 to the minus 11, and you have a maximum chirality violation. So you have a very, very high difference between the left and the right. So that's an example of what somebody like LISA could do at the level of the dipole. So it is not unrealistic.
Okay.
Yeah.
Any last questions? Let me see. Okay, I don't see any hands raised. Okay, good. So then let's stop here. Thanks again, Emma.
Hi.
Very great
Thank
talk.
Thank you.